So let's introduce the speaker at this point, and it's Tim Jay. He's a coworker of mine, and when I asked him would he mind telling his story tonight, he immediately said yes. And then he said, you know that I'm NA, don't you? And I said, yeah. I said, it doesn't matter. This is 12-step recovery that a lot of people come here for a lot of different reasons, and Tim has a solution. And I want to say this, Tim is probably one of the most spiritual people I've ever met. He, for me, I have an office right next door to him, and I see it every day. And I get to see how he navigates through a day at work and how he navigates with clients, and he is the epitome of the 12th step, in my opinion. That he always is thinking and asking that question, how can I best serve? And that is, he's really taught me so much about spirituality and how to really serve. So I really, really appreciate you being here, Tim. So if you don't mind, would you come up, Tim Jay?
My name is Tim, Grave Recovering Addict. Thank you, Joe. Thank you for asking me to be of service. Immediately, of course, I was told that when someone asks you to be of service, you should always say yes. Because somebody was always there for me. I've been in this process for, my clean date is 2409. I have 14 years and some change. And I am so grateful for the program. Because it was a resource that led me to the source, and that was this loving, caring power for whom I choose to call God. When I first got here, Joe says I'm spiritual now. When I first got here, I was nothing spiritual. I mean, in fact, I had resentments about this higher power, didn't want to talk about the higher power. And that was based upon where I came from at that time. To give you a little background about myself, I'm actually what people down here call a Yankee. I'm from Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Racine, Wisconsin. Born and raised up there. Parents came from Mississippi. They moved up to Wisconsin during the great, whatever they call the migration, when all the jobs went up there. They worked for the Chrysler and Case factory in Wisconsin. I'm the oldest of three children. My family was what I call, I didn't know it at the time, but when I got older, this term called dysfunctional, I realized I was like, that was me. My mother actually got pregnant with me when she was 16. She had me when she was 17, so I kind of grew up in the 60s. I was born in the 60s, so it was a little bit different back then. My grandmother made her switch from her high school to go to another high school across town because there was a lot of shame about her being pregnant and all that kind of stuff. So she went to a different high school across town where my father, supposedly her boyfriend, stayed. So there was a lot of stuff going on when I grew up. In fact, my father was what we call today, this word that a lot of girls like, thug. So, because of his lifestyle, my father was murdered when I was 5. So I grew up without a father, but I had a mother who was a tomboy. She was out there playing catch with me, all that kind of stuff. And I heard that a lot from my friends, like, you know, they talked about that, you don't have a father, woo-woo. So my self-esteem was real low growing up. But what I did was I overcompensated. I was real good in school. Got all kind of A's and B's. I grew up again in the 60s and early 70s where they started busing people. So I had to get bused from my part of town to a place where there was almost like this room. There was more Caucasians when there were me. So I felt a little different, right? So. I've always looked at myself as being different because I was always the minority. And then, it for me, it was like I always wanted to belong somewhere. And So when I got good grades, I belonged to the certain group of people. But when I got home, I was that smart, nerdy kid. They picked on me a lot. And what I did to save face with them is I did what they did. We would go to the railroad tracks. You know, on the railroad tracks, they had these real big old rocks, and they had factories on the side of the railroad tracks. And so we would try to see how many windows we could bust in one day. So, I mean, I was real, real rebellious as a child because I wanted to fit in. And me fitting in led me to some certain things that I did and my mother told me one day, you know, my mother was, she did the best she could. I had two sisters. I had a mother who was raising us by herself, and I had some uncles. All my uncles used. My mother was an alcoholic. All my uncles used on my mother's side. My whole family on my father's side used. They were drinkers. I had an uncle die, 37, of cirrhosis. Both of my grandfathers died of cirrhosis. So that was in my family for a long, long time. And by me seeing the effects of alcoholism, I really didn't want to do alcoholism, but the alcohol, so when, eventually how I started was, mom would have these parties on Friday, and all the kids would be in one room, and I would hear them out there yelling, screaming, having fun, and I was like, man, I can't wait till I get grown so I can do that kind of stuff. So then we got old enough that we could start cleaning up after the party. We'd have to go clean up after the party. So immediately, you know, the PBR was a drink at that time. You know, I'm from the, like I said, the Milwaukee area, the beer capital. Drinking was 18. So Paso Blue Ribbon was the stuff. So there were cans everywhere. I would, you know, clean up a little bit in the can. You know, I mean, I've drank, tasted plenty of cigarette butts. But immediately, you know, the feeling of me that I got from the alcohol was like off the chain. So I knew what it was about. My mother would come home, whatever, and she would say, can you go get me a beer? You know, I had got real nice. I started opening the beer for her, taking me a sweet before I gave it to her, you know, just a little bit. And then one day she actually came home. I think I was probably about eight, nine maybe. And she noticed that her beers were kind of missing. She said, you know what? I don't care if you're going to drink. She said, I better have a beer in there when I get home. You know what I mean? I was like, permission slip, right? So I started, you know, drinking every now and then. But I had a couple sisters. I had a sister that was that didn't kind of adhere to the last message about there better be a beer in there when I got home. And she ended up drinking mom's last beer. And after that, it wasn't fun anymore. So I immediately kind of strayed away from that a little bit. But all my friends growing up, they were into doing their own thing. And of course, like I said, I wanted to belong. And I started doing what they did. I had a couple friends that they were like the neighborhood little, you know, the weed people. You know, we solo joints, roll joints up, so single joints, all that kind of stuff. And I did that at 13, and then I started smoking when I was 13. And then, you know, you'll hear some people say, I hear this in treatment a lot, that, you know, weed is good for you. I can tell you that it is not, because I went from an honor roll student to I was still, you know, getting good grades, but I had this class called algebra. And it was different. when I started smoking weed. So I couldn't consecrate, I couldn't do nothing, and I ended up getting my first F, right? And I went from A's to, and some B's to A, B, C, D, and then I had an F. So immediately my mother stopped me from hanging out with people. She told me I couldn't do nothing. You can't go nowhere. It's until your grades change. You know, I played basketball until my grades changed. I couldn't play basketball. So I immediately got back on the grades, ended up playing basketball, ended up getting a scholarship, played basketball. But I didn't stop smoking weed. That's, for me, was the downfall. Again, like I said, alcohol was good, but because I saw the effects of alcohol, I really didn't try to mess with alcohol. But I always had to have some alcohol, right? I think that this whole process for me was alcoholism and my drug addiction was always an escape for me. I really didn't like and personally who I was. Again, like I said, I came up in a time where it was a lot of turmoil and there's a lot of different situations going on with the black and white issues and things of that sort. And again, I went to the white school, so I didn't like who I was, right? I didn't like being black because of the simple fact that it was a lot of stuff going on at the time. You know, there were a lot of stuff going on, right? And so I really didn't like who I was. So I used drugs and alcohol to make me feel good and escape about who I really was. So eventually I needed it, right? I needed it to, because I had no coping skills. I needed it to get through the day. I end up making it through. I still was like, you know, as far as grade wise, I still was in the top 25% of my class, all that kind of stuff. But when I got to college, I'm talking about it took off. Like, I was wide open. There was no mother to tell me to stop. There was nobody saying, get up and go to school, get up and go to your class. In fact, it was fun, right? We used to set our alarm clocks. And I find this like crazy when I think about it now. We used to set our alarm clocks on the floor to wake up to do 6-foot bong hits. And then we would blow the smoke in the hallway. Everybody would open the door, blow the smoke in the hallway, and then go back to bed. When I think about how my drug addiction took over my life, it was crazy. Like, I am really thankful that I had a higher power that looked over me and carried me through that process, because when I look back on who I grew up with, what we did, where I came from, a lot of those people aren't here anymore. And if they aren't here physically, a lot of them are in prison. I got into the program, I got clean. Well, actually, let me just back up a little bit. I was, made it through college. I ended up using with this one lady who was known for always having drugs, whatever. So she told me she wanted to move out of the state. So I moved out of the state with her against my mother's wishes. And I was ended up in Omaha, Nebraska. Right? All on the quest just to go, right? Omaha, Nebraska. I got out there. I was like, I ain't going to no damn Omaha. Ain't no black people in Omaha. No, so, and when I got to Omaha, I told them where I'm from. They was like, I ain't no black people in Wisconsin. Right? So, but I stayed there for about, probably for about 4 or 5 years. And I was on a rampage. All I did was used almost every day. I kept a couple few part-time jobs. I went from a college degree, working to not even wanting to work, right? I didn't want to go to work because I was afraid I was going to miss something. I went back home, right? I got myself together for a little while, went back home, got a job with the university. I was an admissions counselor, and I was driving from place to place to do some stuff, and I started getting high again and drinking, and eventually they wanted me to take a urinalysis, and I told them that I said, nah, I think I'm just gonna quit. So I quit that job, got another job. I was actually doing volunteer work, actually for a congressman. His name was Les Aspin at the time. I became a district representative with him. And I worked with him for probably about 6 years. And he was a congressman. I was a district rep at home. And then he actually became the Secretary of Defense, right? And he wanted me to go with him to be an aide with him in Washington. And I refused to go to Washington because I didn't want to go because I didn't know where I was going to get my dope. So I refused that job and went back out and just started hanging out with people for a long time. And then my sisters, my mother, and everybody had moved from home, and they moved down here. They moved to Atlanta. And my sister ended up getting sick. She was getting sick back and forth. And they were trying to get in touch with me, but nobody could get in touch with me. My mother was calling around asking people, had they seen me? And I was isolated. Nobody knew where I was because I could always get away because I knew where my family was. I could always get away from my family and go hide somewhere and they wouldn't know where I was. But somebody actually found me and told me that my sister was sick, and I came down here. And 2 days after I got here, my sister ended up passing from lupus. But that wasn't enough for me to stop, right? I stayed down here with my mother. We actually lived in Lithonia, right? But as I was coming in on the bus, I was looking around and I knew immediately where to go get my drugs, right? So as I was coming in on the bus, I was looking around, I was like, right there. So I started driving from Lithonia all the way to the west side of Atlanta to get my drugs. I ended up getting stuck over there. My mom was looking around for me for a long time, and eventually what had happened at one point, I ended up going through a roadblock, and they told me that my car was stolen. My mother had called the car and it stole it, right? So they ended up taking me to the, they locked me up, took me back to the cab. My mother came and they had a court date the next morning, and they told, the lawyer told my mother, she was not going to press charges. They was like, well, if you don't press charges, we're gonna lock you up for filing a false report. She said, well, you can lock me up. I just wanted to know where my baby was. That still wasn't enough for me, right? I went back home for about 2 weeks. Went back out again. I never really thought that I was bothering or I was hurting anybody else. I just thought that as long as I stayed away from them, that it wasn't affecting them, right? I didn't even mention in the meantime, I had actually had my daughter when I was 26. And me and her mother didn't have a good relationship at that point. So I kind of abandoned my daughter at the same age as my father had abandoned my family, right? And I only found this out through the step work as I started doing my step work that that's what happened. So again, I didn't think I was bothering anybody. I asked nobody for nothing. I had my own money. I'm good. So one day I went back home after that little incident. I went back home. My grandmother was down here from Wisconsin. I took her to, she wanted to go to bingo. So I took her to the bingo place. I was like, I ain't gonna sit in here while she play no damn bingo. Like, so I said, I probably can run to the west side, come back, get me some, and come back. I end up leaving my grandmother at the bingo place. Right. So my mother had went and got her, and I came back later. And, of course, they just made me feel bad, and I should have felt bad. So I used that guilt as a reason for me to get away again. So I took off. Right? So I got stuck on the west side again. I ended up, right, all this time, I don't have family on the west side. I was just going from place to place, from person to person. I would meet people, they would think I was cool, that you could just stay with me, blase Skippy. I did that, and eventually, I got a little part-time job, got me an apartment over there, and then how I made my money was I was taking the little dope dealers wherever they wanted to go, right? So, did that for a while, and I finally one day I said, I had called my mom and I was like, I don't know if I want to do this no more. She said, are you sure? I said, yeah, I don't think I want to do this no more. She was like, well, I was wondering because you ain't got a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out. You done went to school, you done did all this, you gonna waste your whole damn life. And immediately I got a resentment. I was like, never mind, Right, so I went back out, and about 2 weeks later, I told the lady that I was, my dealer, that I was like, I'm sick of this. And she was like, I was wondering when you were gonna say that. She said, go in there and lay down, get you some rest, and when you wake up, I'll take you somewhere. So I went in there, I slept for 2 days. I ain't wake up to go to the bathroom because I probably hadn't ate nothing. I come to find out, my friend told me, he was like, you was in a crack coma. I said, a crack coma? He said, yeah, you had to pee, you had to shit because you ate shit, So I slept for 2 days. I woke up, she took me to a treatment facility. It was called Jefferson Place at the time. It was a state-run facility. I went there, they had a process where they had like a 50 bed place where the homeless slept. So you had to sleep in the 50 beds, you had to get up in the morning, and then you had to leave, and then you had to come back at 2 o'clock, right? Each day it took me about 2 weeks to get in. So I finally got in, and it's been amazing since then, right? That was like the end of my road where I was physically, mentally, and spiritually bankrupt. I didn't have nothing, and really didn't care I didn't have anything, right? Until I had this moment, or what we call a moment of clarity, where I realized that this stuff was, I asked myself, everybody else knew I needed help, but I asked myself, could it be the drugs? Right? Everybody else knew it but me. So I finally admitted that was what I needed. I went into treatment, and I haven't looked back since then. This process, when I went into treatment, I was introduced, the first thing they gave us, when I got into the treatment program, they gave us an NA book, and an egg. We had groups, right? We had to go to, we had the spiritual ladder, we had the self-esteem, we had the, all those kind of groups. We had to do all those things, and we had to go to meetings. If you didn't make meetings, they put you out, right? So we had to go to meetings. Got introduced to this guy who ended up becoming my sponsor. He is still my sponsor. I heard a lot of stuff about the steps. Like, I'm like, when we got to start working the steps? He said, well, you know, just let me know when you want to stop having the pain. So I immediately, from the inside, I wanted to stop the pain, and I started working steps with my sponsor. He got me into service right away. And I ended up starting to chair meetings at the facility, all that kind of stuff. Started doing step work. Got introduced to the spiritual principles of the program. Found out how important those spiritual principles was and how they could change my life. I think for me, I was very fortunate because most of the people that I was at the treatment facility that I went to were in recovery also. So I had some living proof of how the program worked for people. So I saw it working in their lives, and I knew if it worked for them, that it would probably work for me. So I started, again, doing the step work, doing service work, making meetings on a regular basis, built a network of people. I went through the process. I went to transition, stayed in transition for 2 years. In fact, I was so afraid of going back out that they had to put me out of transition. Right, they said, like, look, son, you gotta go. I was like, I can do meetings, I can help. They said, no, you gotta go, son. I was like, all right. So I end up moving into a house, got my own apartment. And in fact, I think I found out some of the things too when I was there. It's like, they told me I was homeless. I was like, I ain't homeless. You know, I got a place to go. They say, if you ain't got nothing with your name on it, you homeless. I'm like, damn, I'm homeless. Right? So they said, don't be homeless in recovery. So I got a home group, and the same group I normally go to. Right now, I use my home group at Friday at 8 o'clock because I know I picked that home group because Friday, in my book, still is National Get High Day, right? Even if I ain't got no money, I know somebody got paid today, right? So I made that my home group Friday, 8 o'clock, because I knew that I needed to be in a place on Friday so I wouldn't use, right? So I made meetings on a regular basis. In fact, I did 90 and 90. Probably, I did a meeting every day probably for my first 5 years. Because I was afraid of going back out. I mean, I had seen people in the process go back out, go back out, go back out. And I was so afraid of going back out. My sponsor had a book study in a certain area where I used to get high at on the west side. I told him, I can't go there. He's like, what you mean you can't go there? I said, I used to get high right down the street. He said, so what? You clean now, they'll still go down there. So I finally went back down over to that side of town. And as I was coming in on the bus, we're talking about a higher power doing for me what I cannot do for myself. As I was coming in on the bus, I looked to my left. It was a place where I used to get high. That house was tore down, right? So I went down the road some more, and there was some apartments where I used to get high. They were tore down. So I went around the bend to where the meeting was, and the store that they used to hang out at, they had closed down, right? So I'm like, man, this is the higher power doing for me what I cannot do for myself. So I went there and started going to a book study there. Fell in love with the program, start seeing the results of how the program was working in my life. I seen the miracles and coincidences that was not only happening in my life, but it was happening in the lives of others that was in the program with me as well. And then I realized that after about maybe probably about 2 years, I really didn't realize until when I left the transition place that I had lost really the desire to use. I really didn't want to use no more. I was just afraid of using, but I didn't want to use, right? I can't put a specific date on losing that desire, but that's probably one of the best feelings in the world to know that I do not have to use the day, because I remember there were some days where I didn't have a choice. I had to get up, go out, make it happen. It was like the little general. I had to get up. If they say jump up, get up, and go get it, I had to jump up, get up, and go get it. But the program has taught me how to do things to help me not want to use, to make it easier to not want to use. I have, like I said, I have been involved in the program doing service day one. I'm still doing service to this day. My wife was like, and I just got married, I told her I was gonna take a year off from the service structure just to spend with her, because my sponsor's a service junkie and it ended up costing him his marriage. And he said, you're gonna take a year off because you're not gonna be like me. And so this year I'm gonna take a year off from doing service. But I'm so involved in the program, or Narcotics Anonymous, because this program not only saved my life, it gave me a life, right? And what I mean by it gave me a life is it showed me that, you know, the second tradition talks about there are only two positions. One is the ultimate authority, which is a loving God as we express in our group consciousness, and our leaders are trusted servants. So I am just a trusted servant, and God trusts me enough to help his other children who are suffering right now to get out of the grips of addiction, right? How many programs can you go to where the mess of your life has become a message to help somebody else? Right. How many places can you go to get that? Like, you, the stuff you've done, how you ruined your life in the beginning can help somebody else save their life. So I got clean. I started doing the service work. I end up meeting people inside the fellowship that were actually, again, like I said, the people that I went through treatment with, the faculty were all recovering addicts, and they all had CADCs, CACs, and they showed me how to get my CAC, all that kind of stuff. So I did that. End up getting into the field, right? And it's kind of unique how I got into the field too, because there was a place where my mother, again, she died from complications of disease. She always knew I needed help. And she actually negotiated me getting into treatment. She said, if I go to detox, would you go to treatment? I said, yeah, if you go, I'll go, right? So she ended up going to St. Jude's to the detox center. And then 5 days, when she got out, she stayed like 17 days. When she got out, I went in, and then 30 days after I went in, I ended up going to my mom's house, and she had passed away. She had a stroke. And so, again, this, a lot of times, like, this disease of addiction is so cunning and baffling. It's like, I understood that I couldn't do alcohol, but I wanted to do something, right? So even when I got clean, I wanted to do something, right? So I kept smoking, meeting cigarettes, coffee. And eventually the smoking took a toll on me too, right? I kept saying, damn, my feet hurt, right? So I went to the doctor. The doctor said, do you smoke? I said, yeah. He said, you might want to quit smoking. I said, man, what that got to do with my damn feet? Right, because I didn't want to give up the smoking, right? So Joe quit smoking first, then I ended up quit smoking, and then my feet don't hurt. So I saw the benefits of not smoking, so I ain't smoked no more. But it's all due to the process of recovery. Like in the AA literature, it says either we go through the pains of withdrawal or we keep using. Right? So I went through the pains of withdrawal and I stopped smoking. Right? I tell the clients now, I was like, if you think drugs and alcohol make you feel good, try helping somebody and see how that makes you feel. Right? When you help somebody, that is like one of the best feelings in the world. And I wanted to do that so bad, right? I wanted to help other people get to this point. So I end up trying to get a job at St. Jude's at first, and they didn't want to hire me because I didn't have enough clean time, so they said. I think I had like 3 years at that time. So as I came around, I was doing an internship, and then I went to a training, right? And I seen this one guy who was, doing a training at the place, right? And I said, hey, you was at St. Jude's? He's like, yeah, it was Mr. Rusty right there. And I said, hey, wouldn't give me a job because they said I didn't have enough clean time. He said, how much clean time you got now? I said, I'm going on 5 years. He said, well, come on back. We got a part-time position. If you like that, we'll see if we can get you in. So I went back, took the part-time position, and about 3 months later, a full-time position opened up. I applied for that, and I've been there ever since. I've now been there for 10 years. And I'm just so thankful that through this process, like I said, the program not only saved my life, it gave me a life. So the life that it has given me has been a life of servanthood. Like, I need to help other people get to the point where I am in my recovery, right? Because somebody did it for me. And I thank Joe for allowing me to come up here and share my story. I thought this was gonna be a long, long time. I said, an hour? I could have just did it in like 3 minutes, man. I tried drugs kicked my ass, I surrendered, and now I wanna share, you know what I mean? But I appreciate it because, like, recovery is a beautiful thing. Things happen in this process. Like, I'm no longer running from me, right? And I love who I am today. I like what I do. I like who I am. I like the people I hang out with. When I look back on using days, I was with people who were like, I'll look around and be like, hey, what the fuck I'm doing in here? You know what I mean? It kept me longer than I wanted to stay. It introduced me to people who I didn't want to be introduced to. But those same people today that are in the recovery process are the people that saved my life, right? The people that I didn't want to hang with are the people that saved my life. And God used those same people, because I'm so hard-headed, to help me get clean, right? And I would thank you that you told me about that. And I thank everybody for allowing me to be up here to be of service. And it's a beautiful day to be clean. Those of you who don't know that probably ain't clean. Thank you for letting me share.
Thank you so much, Tim. Thank you so much. Really beautiful. Thank you for sharing your story with us. You just got a little peek of what I get to see every day. The same attitude of service and wanting to be there for other people. It's really an inspiring story. Thank you again, Tim. Appreciate it.